Indie Nation listeners, welcome to Lumpy as I hijack the stream and, well, I play a little Symfinity for you. We have three of the five members live in the studio. Well, cyber live, as Lumpy always likes to say, because they're not really in the studio literally with me, but they're in the studio with me in the sense that I'm cyber live in Cleveland. Hey guys, where are you coming from?
We're in New York City.
New York City. Well, at least we're in the same time zone.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that can be so rough with the internet world. And you are three of the five members of the five-piece band Symfinity, as I mentioned. Where would they find you?
On the internet?
Oh, yes.
We are pretty much anywhere that they would want to find us. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Bandcamp, iTunes, you name it. We even have a Pinterest.
Yeah, we're on Pinterest.
Pinterest. Of course, the female would mention Pinterest, right?
Yeah.
We have a Pinterest account, actually, Indie Nation does, and I do try to like, post to it once a day, you know, at least like some stuff. As I said, we opened the interruption of the bot up with a tune from their most recent album. I believe it's called Intangible Dreams, isn't that what it is?
That's our album name, yes.
And, well, I opened with the first track. It's titled Overture. And I think it gives a listener a pretty good taste of what your style is or sound is. But I'm going to leave that more up to you guys to describe. Personally, I'm one who hates the term genre.
Yeah, we get it, too.
you know how that came about, right?
Yeah.
It was a marketing thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know what Duke Ellington said about genre?
Actually, I don't think I do.
Actually, Ray Charles gets quoted for it more, but he was quoting Duke Ellington. Duke Ellington said there's two types of music, good and bad.
Oh, I remember that, yeah. It's so true.
There's two genres. But yeah, honestly, I dropped a $10 bill on your album today over there at Bandcamp.
Thank you very much.
Got the whole thing. I think it was worth every penny. And I'm going to tell the listeners the same thing. I think it's worth every penny. Some really great stuff. I do believe from the email correspondence, you said you also have your engineer, who's one of your players in the band with you tonight.
Yes, Crystal's right here.
Oh, that's one of the things I definitely like to talk about is the engineering. You know, what you got going on, how you recorded it. That's one of the things that myself as a geek, I'm more of an audio engineer than anything. Okay.
Okay.
I'm actually in the IMDb for audio engineering. Did some soundtrack work in the past. I'm a big fan of the Telarc minimal mic technique and for, you know, live concert recordings and all that stuff. But yeah, that's one of the things I definitely like to talk about. But, you know, just you guys, in your own words, tell us a little bit about yourselves.
Well, we're the three of us anyway. We all studied classically at colleges, I think. All three of us either have master's degrees in music or we're working on them right now.
Almost finished with one. Almost.
And a master's degree in music, correct me if I'm wrong, is what they would call a terminal degree. There's no PhD in music, is there?
Oh, there is there a PhD.
Is there really?
We just don't want them right now.
Yeah. No, I would have a job if I had one of those.
And where did you guys study?
Well, Crystal and I went to NYU for our master's degrees.
I'm at Queens College right now for my master's.
And you're all classically trained in some sense?
That's right.
And in the five-piece band, what are the instruments you guys normally play? I know there's going to be some variety.
Well, I normally sing and play guitar. That's normally what I do live. And then Crystal over here plays piano. Lynette plays.
And I'm the flutist.
She's flute. And we have a bassist and drummer as well.
So that's your normal lineup, a bass player, a flutist, guitarist, keyboardist, drummer?
Yeah, that's our normal lineup. Sometimes we have random people join us. We have, you know, music for every orchestra instrument written out. So we've had, you know, violin players join us. Fiddle players join us, trumpets, you know, pretty much any orchestra instrument we've had at some point in time play with us live.
Now let me ask you this. This is just something I'm kind of reading into your music a little bit. Do you guys rely on improv a lot?
There's no improv in this music at all.
So this stuff's entirely structured and...
It's entirely structured. Mm-hmm. Everything's written out. Everything's been orchestrated, so it all fits together.
Now, when you're composing it, do you use improv to compose it, or is it all written out ahead of time?
My songwriting, you know, it's different for every song, so sometimes I'll sit at a piano and try and come up with a melody, or sometimes it'll be a guitar. And recently I just, you know, come up with melodies in the shower and write them down later.
I can relate to that. I remember when I was younger and still playing in bands, and we did original material. We did cover material as well. But I remember sitting in a restaurant one time and writing out lyrics for an entire song on a matchbook cover because that's all we had.
Yeah. You use whatever you need to use.
When the muse talks to you, you better scribble.
Yeah, exactly.
What would you say your influences are as a band and as individual members?
I guess my vision for the band is sort of just, you know, rock plus orchestra, whatever that means. And I try to have it kind of be representative of anything that I've enjoyed over the years. So I've listened to a lot of European sonic metal. I enjoy a lot of American bands, too. A lot of metal, a lot of hard rock. I used to listen to a lot of classic rock. So that's kind of my vision for the band, and that's kind of what I've listened to.
You guys definitely have a great sound, in my
opinion. Thank you.
I personally hear some Jethro Tull type of influence, especially with the addition of a flute player. Come on, I mean, you know.
Yeah, Lynette, why don't you talk about... your influences. Why don't you talk about your influences?
Let's see, my influences. I mean, I've always liked rock music ever since I was a kid, but I was also playing flute since I was a kid, and it wasn't until like college that it kind of hit me. Oh, hey, I can do both. And for a while, I was looking for Nightwish cover bands in the area, and I typed it into Craigslist, and that's how I found Symphinity, because Sean had listed Nightwish as one of the influences. I'm like, oh, it's close enough, you know, to have good songs. I think I could fit in well here. And I played for them and been playing for them for the past 2 years now.
That's cool. Any other influences? I mean, we talked about mainly some of the rock influences. How about some of the classical influences?
Yeah, Crystal, what do you think?
I think we're all big fans of metal.
You cut out there. I think you were saying all big fans of metal.
Yeah. And also, I know Sean here. He's also a big fan.
So I'll bet you guys have probably even heard of, like, Nighthawk.
Nighthawk?
Yeah.
It sounds a little familiar.
Look up Nighthawk Sonic Attack sometime. I think it was, like, circa 1980, 1979 that I first heard them on a college radio station.
Oh, okay.
And it's like, oh, wow, metal can do this, too? That's cool. You know, I mean, it's just like, because I really hate the, you know, the whole genre thing. Because I also hear, like, some Yellow Magic Orchestra type of sound coming out of you guys, too, with some of your material. I don't even know if you're familiar with them. A lot of American people aren't. They're a Japanese band, you know.
Okay. I think what it comes down to is that we're really... all these classical musicians that just really love rock music. And I think that's kind of where this is coming from, is it is rock music that just has a little extra added to it.
Oh, it definitely has more than a little extra, in my opinion. But it's really good. Now, like I said earlier, a little bit about the engineering. How'd you guys record this? You record this on your own? You record it in a studio? Yada, yada, yada. Because, I mean... that's one of the things that really impressed me about it, you know, from my aspect especially, is like, it's very well produced.
Crystal, go.
Well, so I engineered it. I was actually at the NYU.
You keep cutting out, Crystal.
All right. I recorded this at the NYU Studios. I was getting my master's in music technology, studying. And I worked at one of the studios there, and I had access to this. On this project, I thought it was very interesting, classical and rock ensemble, and so we started recording.
And now,
final process of
You're cutting out like every third word. You need to take your mic gain up a little bit, maybe, so that you're not. Or get closer.
Don't touch
the mic
anything, Crystal. Let's all not right, touch anything. It'll explode. Just talk closer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So I recorded this at the NYU studios, and I was actually getting my master's in music technology since I was studying recording. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So I wanted to take on this project because, you know, that's where I met Sean, and I thought it was a very interesting project to do classical and rock together. And it was a time when I was trying to practice a lot with recording rock groups. And I had worked at some studios at NYU, and because I had access there, that's when I started to record a lot of songs that Sean had ready. And then we ended up making Intangible Dreams. And then we also have recorded the second upcoming album as well.
Oh, so the upcoming album's already done? Or at least recorded?
We've recorded most of it. It's going to take some editing. We did record a live 50-piece orchestra for this new album.
Wow. Now, how did you record the live orchestra?
This is where it gets interesting. Go, Crystal.
I mean, what I'm interested in this, I'm a big fan of Telarc Recording, which is mainly a classical label that is, it's pretty much defunct. But they were like the first album, they were the first company to record an orchestra digitally. And the phenomenal thing about the way they did it is their engineer is a big fan of minimal mic recording. So they recorded the Cleveland Orchestra with two mics and got these beautiful recordings because, you know, no phase elimination type of thing. So I'm just kind of curious, how did you guys record this 50 piece?
So, you know, the studio actually can't hold all 50 people.
No.
So the max it would actually hold is 25. We actually just recorded by section. So we did like the brass section separately, the woodwinds, and then separately, the strings separately. And there were some people who couldn't make even those sessions, and we did them separately. But it still worked out. As long as we had two, like, microphones that represented those two mics, which are the room mics. And it really comes down to the room mics doing implementing that in the recording. That helps a lot, which is why the recordings that you mentioned, just using two mics would be enough to make the recording.
Well, especially for a live recording, it can often be more than enough. But you guys were basically using the same studio mics, and you were doing it section by section or individual by individual, so you kept all that pretty much constant, right? I mean, your phase elimination problem was kept pretty much constant because
phase elimination's constant.
Because your recording environment's identical.
Right. Yes. I mean, it varied from instrument to instrument of how to handle that. Like, for instance, trumpet was one instrument that caused a lot of phasing. But the key was, again, using the room mics. As long as, even if we recorded one trumpet player at a time, as long as we had two room mics that recorded that trumpet player, it actually turned out fine and you didn't have any real phasing. And then at the end of the day, you put it all together and it could actually sound like a full orchestra that was played all at once.
And we should mention that the reason why it worked out so well is because Crystal had these players, if they're recording three trumpet parts, the same player, she would actually have them sit in different chairs to record each part.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. Brilliant.
Yeah.
No, because then you got exactly the phase you should have.
Yes, and then it's, you know, with the room mics, you know, it's like there are three separate players there. You just combine tracks together, and it sounds like there's three players.
Well done. I mean, that's exactly the way to do it, in my opinion. I'm just a big fan of minimal miking. I have portable recording equipment. I don't know how familiar you are with the Zoom brand.
Yeah, we got one of those.
I've got the H2 and I've got the H4.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I go out and I record live bands on a regular basis, and they're just like, that little thing recorded all of that? And I'm like, yeah, you know, it's something special about XY miking technique. You know, it just really works out well for live recording. In my opinion, it's a lot easier to go and produce a live show, especially with an orchestra, because an orchestra, these guys are all pros. They all know exactly how loud to draw their harp or blow their horn. And if you set that XY mic up in the right place and you set your levels up right, guess what's going to happen with your recording? It's going to sound just like you're in the room, right?
Yeah. I mean, XY is good usually, because it also, it gives like a very close up definition of the recording as well as giving a sense of the room.
I will be right back. I don't know if you guys heard that or not, but I had to shut it off because I know somebody was going to. There was a clock radio going off in the background. Did you hear that?
Ah, yeah, we heard something.
Yeah, one of my cats just walked over the clock radio and hit snooze.
Oh, that's
funny. Oh, I better fix that. sorry about that. I apologize. No, but I honestly think it was just very well produced, very well engineered. Kudos to you, Crystal. Is that right? Is that who not who the engineer was for your band?
Yes, it was Crystal.
Yes. Yes.
Who writes most of the songs, if not all?
I write the songs mostly.
You write the songs, and is there any overbearing theme to this? Any of these about anything specifically?
I mean, it varies. I mean, Intangible Dreams is kind of like, it's a lot of my earlier writing that I just try to pick songs that I thought would fit together. And the overture, which we're going to listen to coming up, is actually a combination of several songs that I combined them to make it sound like it's an overture to something, like, you know, much like you would do for a musical, you know?
That was actually the one I opened with before we got on the air, Overture.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so yeah.
They just heard that one.
Okay, great. Then they know what I'm talking about.
Are there any songs that you like to push as like, you know, your style? Like a lot of times you'll be asked, hey, what should we play off of this album, you know, by a radio station so that they understand what your sound is or whatever. Is there anything on the album that you would put in that category?
What do you guys think? What's the most Symphony sounding track on Intangible Dreams?
I was thinking. My Hidden Manor.
All right. So I think our consensus is the last two tracks, actually. Night Through Day and My Hidden Manor really represent our sound, at least for the first album, anyway.
Night Through Day and My Hidden Manor, right?
Yeah.
We're going to put those in to close it with.
Night Through Day is an epic, I warn you. It's 7 minutes long.
I really don't care much about epic, actually. I'm not doing the lump cast every Friday night right now because I've got all these other, I've got these concert productions, I'm working on a special 8-bit themed production thing as well. So I kind of put the lump cast on hold, but I'm going to tell you every Friday night when I normally start the lump cast at 8:00, I kick it off with one tune. It's titled House He Grooves. It was a live recording done in 1999, and it's 28 minutes long. So I really don't care. I don't really care about long, okay?
Well, I think Night Through Day is, you know, one of my favorite songs on the album. I know it's one of Crystal's favorites, too. It's the thing I like about it is it has everything. You know, it opens up with that sort of acoustic vibe, and then it just builds from there until it's this heavily orchestrated, almost metal, almost prog metal sounding thing. But, you know, there's the song embedded in there too, that you'll find mainstream song forms embedded in there. So it's hopefully relatable for people.
You say mainstream song forms embedded in there. I wonder how many people are actually going to comprehend what you mean by that. You know,
it's a long song. I mean, a lot of people tell me it doesn't feel like 7 minutes, so I guess that's a good thing. But,
you know, thinking about it, no, I have heard the tune. I've listened to the entire thing from start to finish at least 3 times.
Wow.
Still having a hard time picking favorite tracks, to be honest with you. It's a good, solid. I'm trying to remember, how many tracks is it, 12 or 14?
It is 12, yeah, 12.
but it's a good, solid 12-song album, and it's one of those albums where you're going to have a hard time picking a favorite. And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the premise of this album. It's every song's a little different. I mean, we do kind of have a style that's, some of them sound kind of like each other, but I think there's something for everyone on this album. You know, there's people that like different types of music, so I think there's enough variety in here that I would expect everyone to have a different favorite song.
If they can actually pick one, I think.
If they can pick
one. I think that is really a very fair way to describe the tracks on your album, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
It's going to be very difficult for any listener out there to pick a favorite song out of these 12. You know, and it really kind of limits us only legally being able to play three.
Yeah, it's tough because, I mean, a lot of them sound very different from each other.
And then back to the band and the members. Now, are you all from the greater New York area, as it's often referred to?
That is.
Yeah, I am.
Yeah, well, that's from the area.
I'm originally from Atlanta, Georgia.
And I'm originally...
Go on.
Oh, I'm originally from Atlanta, Georgia. But I moved here about 6 years ago, mainly because of I was doing my master's at NYU.
And I'm from Oregon. I grew up on the coast, and then I did college over there, and then I moved here about 7 years ago for grad school.
And what about the other members that aren't present right now tonight? Where are they from, and what are they about?
Wen Tao is from China. Our drummer Rob is the area, right?
Yeah, he's from Brooklyn. Rob's from Brooklyn, yeah.
So you guys are pretty much, right now at least, the greater New York area, but not necessarily. Somebody came from an era where the asphalt gets so hot in the summer it melts, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, so for now we're all based here in New York.
Been to Atlanta, great area.
Oh, yeah, I like the city. I grew up there most of my life.
I couldn't take the heat. I'll be the first to admit. I'm like, you know that one guy you all hate that's waiting for the snow? And wants the 20 degrees and crisp weather. Everybody says you're a nutcase. That would be me. Okay.
I like it cold, too.
Once it's 20 degrees and the humidity drops out of the air, that's perfect weather to me. I don't know about you guys.
maybe a few degrees cold, warmer, I bet.
One question I like to ask, whether they're a movie producer, an actor, a writer, a director, a musician, there's probably somebody listening right now that aspires to do exactly what you're doing. What pointers or tips or advice would you give them?
To art or play in a symphonic rock band, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, I think what's important is that, first and foremost, you write songs. No matter what genre you want to play, or what, you know, lack of genre you want to play. I think it's important to just practice music, write songs, and then work on your songs. If you want to do something like what we're doing, we're kind of an interesting situation. A lot of bands that have orchestra as part of their sound will hire an orchestrator, or some professional, or often the keyboard player will, you know, come up with a loose arrangement for them to work off of. But in our case, I'm the one who orchestrates all the music because I went to grad school and I learned how to do that. So that being said, grad school is very expensive, and I don't necessarily recommend it if rock band is your ambition. if you're trying to... get a teaching job and you want to get a PhD, then I think that's a good track to go. But I wouldn't necessarily recommend that anybody follow in my footsteps.
I would say that's well said. You did give the most common response, though. Most often people in your position that have already achieved, you know, something like this, will just tell people, get out there and do it. You know what I mean? Get out there and write, get out there and play.
I think writing's a very important part. I mean, that's where you show your voice. That's where you create the art that is you.
I agree with you. I think writing and original material is a very important part of being a performing musician, a recording musician. I also wish that the industry would kind of lighten up on the cover tune thing. because the cover tune, I've been in bands. Just a little bit for you guys and the listeners right quick. I don't play anymore. I have carpal tunnel in both hands.
Oh, I used to have that, actually. I used to have carpal tunnel.
I don't have it that bad anymore, and I can still play, but I just can't commit to a band or a recording, if you know what I mean, because it does flare up from time to time. But it's like, I understand the original material thing. You know, you want to write, you want to put that out there. But I think it's also kind of important that you can demonstrate your style and your ability with cover tunes, if you know what I mean. Because and the industry is just so anal about that at the moment. It's like if you do a cover tune and you don't dot every I and get every permission necessary, they're going to come and try and throw you in jail. I just think that's kind of unfortunate. John Lennon had a saying about, you know, the Beatles did a lot of cover tunes when they were early in their career. And that was the norm then. They weren't called cover tunes then. They were called standards.
Yeah.
You know, in other words, if you're a band, you did these. These were the standard songs. And Lennon said they weren't ripoffs. They weren't covers. They were tributes. Why don't the morons get it right?
Yeah. I mean, in our case, I mean, I think there's a lot of bands out there now that they're in the unfortunate position where they'll do a cover song and then it becomes their most famous track. And then that's what they're known for, is doing somebody else's song.
It's also gotten to the point with music where you can do a cover song and people may not even know it's a cover song because of the way the pop charts are today.
Yeah, that's true. It's very true. People just don't know.
Oh, wow, that's a great tune, you know.
Yeah, and in some ways it's marketed that way.
Good case in point was Run DMC with Walk This Way. Everybody, who's these guys Aerosmith that are with them? It's kind of true, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's definitely true.
Honest to God, true story. I was at a pool hall shooting pool one night, and somebody put on that Walk This Way by Run DMC.
Yeah.
And I was telling these younger kids, I'm like, yeah, they're with an older band. The band's name's Daryl Schmidt. You got to look them up. And the kids were like, oh, yeah, really?
That's funny.
So I had all these like 14-year-olds looking for Daryl Schmidt on the internet. Just go figure.
For us, I mean, covers are something that we enjoy doing, but it's never been like the focus of the band. The focus has always been to write original music and to be known for doing that. But we do enjoy covers. We'll play a few live every now and then. We don't really anticipate on recording them ever. We might do like a few YouTube videos with some songs, and because I think it's really fun to orchestrate some of these songs and do a different spin on it.
What covers do you do when you do them live?
We tend to do like, you know, modern rock sort of stuff. You know, it varies, but it'll be other rock bands usually.
And I take it you do them one of the two ways I like to do covers, based on what you said. I think there's two ways to do covers, in my opinion. One is you do it exactly as it was done, sounding like a clone of the band. Or number two, you do it like Johnny Cash did Hurt, and you make it your own.
Yeah, that's exactly how you have to do it. You either have to do it and nail it and do it better than the original artist did it, so it's believable. Or you have to do something completely different. And what we like to do is, you know, be completely different, because I think our sound is completely different as it is. So why not just take our sound and apply it to something else?
Oh, I think that's a great way to go.
Yeah.
And by the way, that Johnny Cash cover tune, Hurt, I just mentioned.
Yeah.
He usually did about 200,000 downloads, you know, views on YouTube. And he did like 2 million on that one.
Yeah. That got pretty famous.
I think he pretty much did, you know, like you said, just do it your own way and just blow it out of the water.
Yeah.
Because
you could still nail it if you do it your own way, so.
Yeah, you can. You can. I think that's an important point to note. I mean, it's doing the same type of thing, expressing your creativity. It's maybe not your material. And again, that's why I think cover songs are an important thing. That I just think it's really unfortunate how the industry comes down on artists about that. I'm not sure how closely you follow that. We obviously follow that pretty closely here at the station.
Yeah.
But that's their latest crackdown on copyright violations, is they're going after the Vimeo and YouTube people that are doing cover songs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't follow it too much. I mean, we just mainly focus on ourselves and try to see what we can do.
Well, I mean, you know, frankly, if you think about it, though, it's the cover songs that made Justin Bieber.
Yeah, and a lot of these artists, that's the case.
You know, and it's just like, now that he's a mainstream artist and they got him on their labels and they got him in their pocket, they don't really seem to care much that that's how he started.
Yeah.
kind of funny how that works, right?
It is funny how that works. Yeah, it's how it's planned. It's all this stuff is planned out like that. So
it's the Illuminati.
Yeah.
We're coming up on about a half hour, and I got two more tracks in the queue, and I'm trying to think of anything else I might want to ask you, and I'm kind of at a blank. Is there anything else you guys would like to mention?
Well, I mean, you got the two longest songs on the album queued up, so that solves half of your problem right there. I guess what we should mention is that we are working on a second album, and we did mention that it's going to be with a full orchestra. There's going to be 12 tracks on that as well. I don't know when it's going to be released. Hopefully next year. Point. We're also we're working on an acoustic EP as well. We've managed to put this together because, you know, it's taking the other album so long because of all the work that needs to be done that I figured, why not just make an easy album, you know, and release something. So we have a few acoustic tracks. We're going to release them on an EP probably sometime. I'd really like to do it in the next few weeks. That might be too ambitious, but as soon as we can get them released, we will.
Now, when you're doing these recordings, do you spend a lot of time in post-production or minimal?
What do you think? Do we spend a lot of time in post-production?
Well, for the first album, for sure, and I expect that the upcoming album will be for sure. There's, you know, when you're dealing with two really extreme ensembles, rock and classical, there's gonna be certainly a lot of post-production with that.
Yeah, and how many tracks are you mixing here?
That's probably gonna be around, I would say roughly around 70.
That's a lot of post-production.
Yeah, it's gonna take us a while.
It's a lot better today than it was when I first started, guys. So I'll just give you that. I don't know how old you are, but I'll be 50 come February.
Yeah.
And back in my day, editing meant cutting 1-inch tape.
Yeah. Fortunately, we don't have to do any of that. Editing's pretty easy in Pro Tools. That's what we usually do.
Pro Tools. Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that nice?
It is. It's so easy to edit. That's the one thing I like about it, anyway. It's really easy to edit.
And this is where we'll give away our ages. Do any of you understand what I mean by the term ping-ponging?
Ping-ponging?
Wait, in the production aspect?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I remember seeing that in Pro Tools, as far as a delay.
That's it's not the same thing. Ping-ponging goes back to the day, like when I was back in the studio and basically when I started doing studio audio recording, it was a patch cord monophonic Moog. You recorded one note, you rolled your tape back, and you recorded the next. Literally, that's how you recorded back in the 60s and the 70s. Everything was monophonic. You could do one note at a time. So if you wanted a major chord, that meant you had to do three recordings to get that one chord. and the technique ping-ponging came about because you only had four tracks.
Right.
So let's say you were going to do a G, which a G, C, D, and then a G major.
Yeah, or G major, yeah. Or GBD.
I'm sorry.
We know our theory.
Yeah, GBD. Well, no, theory is something you learn and then try to forget, okay?
Yeah.
But, you know, so you'd go and you record the G, and then on the track two, you record the D, and then maybe on track three, you record the B. And then now you got your chord, so now you roll the tape back, and you play back the three tracks to record it to the fourth, to free up the other three for some more music.
Right.
That was ping-ponging.
So you're basically making stems.
I guess it's, yeah. But you overdubbing each.
It was the only way you could do it, because, I mean, you could do one note at a time in the day.
Yeah, it's pretty limiting. I can't imagine doing what we're doing.
I'll tell you what is the nice thing about that disappearing. You guys probably wouldn't have felt, because, you, like you said, you script everything out. Everything's composed. Everything's prearranged for you guys.
Yeah. Yep, I write out the music, I orchestrate it, I arrange it, and then I hand sheet music to people. That's what I do.
I mean, in the old days, in the studio, the electronic music studios recording, you had to do it that way.
Yeah.
Improv was not even a conversation, okay? Improv was not even a thought. It was like, what are you talking about? You're going to improv in an electronic music studio? happening, dude. But... nowadays, thanks to the technology, you can kind of get away from that and be a little bit more creative without, you know, having to worry about the technical aspect, which is a good thing and a bad thing. I mean, the good thing is musically you can be more creative. The bad thing is we might have to, like, double think what a major chord is, you know?
Yeah, but then you find a band like us with, like, I don't know, 4 or 5 master's degrees between us, and it's like...
Actually, I don't even know. Who's the guitarist amongst you?
I play the guitar.
Yeah. And are you familiar with the technique of learning your improv based off the root note and scale forms on the neck?
I guess I could see that. It's nothing I really deal with on guitar. I guess we're saying about, you know, trying to forget theory and stuff. That's kind of how playing guitar was for me when I first started, because, you know, I'd probably been playing music for a decade at that point, and I just took up guitar and started playing, and I realized, oh, I don't have to think about things. I can just play.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's how songs started just coming together, and I didn't really think about it. I think a lot of it was improv in terms of the songwriting at the beginning. Some songs like Night Through Day, which we're about to hear, might reflect that. That was one of the first songs I sort of wrote. And then I kind of forgot about it, but then I orchestrated it, so it ended up on the album. So,
yeah, my one guitar instructor, I was kind of like, I played guitar for a lot of years. But,
yeah.
And I knew how to read and write music because I played trumpet in middle school.
I did that too.
But... I didn't know how to read and write music in terms of guitar. I just kind of learned, and I learned the Lennon chords, and I did rhythm guitar. I was, I had an interesting lineup of bands I was in when I was in 16. I was in 3 bands, a metal band, a country band, and a polka band.
That's pretty good variety.
You know, but not only did I know the 7 Who chords, but I knew the John Lennon chords. So, you know, as a rhythm guitarist in the 70s, that was a pretty good deal, you know.
Yeah.
But I actually went back in my mid-20s and actually took lessons. And I took a full year off and did nothing but theory with one instructor.
Yeah, that's one thing I would mention to anybody who wants to do what we're doing. I think lessons are very good. I think, you know, learning the theory behind it and learning orchestration, especially if you want to do this, it's very helpful. Get a teacher. Don't necessarily go to college to do it, because that's really expensive.
Well, I was really, really lucky with the instructor I got. I had a couple instructors at this guy's studio, and eventually I was able to actually take lessons from this guy. His name was John Stable Jr., and I know you're like, who the hell is that, right?
Yeah.
He was like the studio guitarist of the 40s and 50s in the state of Ohio.
Oh, okay.
He recorded with Duke Ellington, Patsy Cline, Mel Torme. You go into his little music shop, and there's an autographed picture that says, thanks for jamming with me. And at the very bottom, it's signed Joe Pass. You know, it's just like, okay. If you get a chance, look up on YouTube John Stiebel, and you're going to find a lot of stuff by his son. His son's a world-class drummer, and his son owns the shop now.
Oh, yeah.
I did find one video of John Stiebel doing some old standards at 80-some years old.
Oh, wow, that's great.
I have to impress with you just the level this guy was. You ever see the cover of a Mel Bay book, and it says, especially for you, Mel Bay, on the guitar headstock? Ever notice, like, every Mel Bay book one has that headstock with the big diamond on it, and it says, especially for you, Mel Bay?
Oh, yeah.
You know why?
Yeah.
That's a D'Angelico guitar.
Okay.
D'Angelico only made guitars for you if you were an accomplished guitarist. And you still had to pay him. The man's logbook sold for $40,000.
Wow.
Okay, now, Brian Setzer of the Stray Cats owns two D'Angelicos. And one of them, the headstock actually says, especially for you, John Stiebel Jr. Because John Stiebel sold it to... I actually played on that guitar at lessons.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that was the classic guitarist John Stiebel was. And, yeah, I asked you that question and led into that story because I knew you were going to say, like, take lessons. Study it.
Yeah.
Learn it. Learn it from somebody who knows it. It's okay to forget it later.
Yeah, because then you can do whatever you want to do.
But the point is you had the discipline and the structure to learn it.
Yeah. And I think that's really important.
It is.
With what we're doing, it's so structured that you can't just improvise your way through it. You really need to write the music.
Well, I don't think you're going to get the improv down unless you had the theory down at least once in your life.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, once you get to a point where you know that stuff, then you can do the improv and you can come up with things that will probably fit together with something else that you're doing.
Yep, and if you're doing improv and you screw up, just remember what Carlos Santana always does if he does that.
Yeah, what'd he say?
He does it three times and then he goes on, treats it like jazz. I actually saw them live and saw him do that. He made a mistake on a tune, and he just repeated the same error three times. It made it sound jazzy.
Oh, that's funny.
Think about it, though. It's true, though, isn't it?
It's true. I mean, you can apply this to writing music. I mean, you do something three times and it becomes a thing, you know, and it becomes emotive.
Yeah. And it can be wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Frank Zappa tried to do that at least three times in every song he ever wrote. Let's find something that shouldn't fit and make it fit. Now, there's another guy we could go on about forever.
Yeah, right.
And before we do that, let's you know, roll it on out of here before we go on for 4 hours. But one thing I would like you guys to do one more time before we kick it back to Night Through Day and My Hidden Manor from your latest EP. Or sure. It's actually an album.
Yeah.
Where do they find you on the internet?
You can find us. It depends what you want from us as a band. If you want music, go to CD Baby, buy the CD. If you just are a casual listener, whatever, you want to go on Spotify, check us out there. Obviously, we're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, we're on social media, pretty much any Bandcamp, any social media that you could imagine. And, you know, as you probably know, Lumpy, we're on Twitter like all the time, or at least I am, and we're always happy to talk to people. So, don't feel shy about reaching out to us or, you know, checking out the tunes.
And are you guys playing out on any regular basis, touring?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. We got a show later this month in New Jersey in Tom's River, so like Black Friday, 29th. Mm-hmm. And then we'll be in Pottsville, Pennsylvania on the 6th of December.
Wow, you're actually going to be fairly close to me.
Hey, come check us out. I'm sure it'll be a great night.
I may do that. Anything else you want to tell the listeners?
Yes. Anything else?
No. Mm. Oh, well, I guess one thing, it's a random fact I like to add about the recording, the upcoming. I actually had a consultation from one of the Within Temptation engineers, and I had asked him if what suggestions he would make for recording a symphonic orchestra. So it was very interesting. He actually was very helpful and very kind to share his ideas. And for him, it came down to using the room mics. So I thought that. So everything he had said, it was pretty much what I had experienced. But I thought it was
So he does like he does record in sections, like woodwinds, brass, and strings. So it's like a common thing to do usually for like a symphonic rock band.
It's good to hear that you're doing the right thing from somebody, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really nice. I mean, when I found out Crystal actually heard back from this guy, I was really excited. And everything she's done so far sounds amazing so far. So I'm really excited about the new album. So, yeah, I mean, it's been fun putting all this together.
Well, without further ado, let's kick it back to the queue. And, well, we're going to kick it off with Night Through Day.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Lumpy, for having us. This is great.
Oh, you're very welcome. And you know, thank you for joining me. I really appreciate it. This is actually what I live for. But without further ado, let's get to Night Through Day and My Hidden Manor, and we can talk a bit more while that's actually streaming.
Great. Thanks.
Night through day. If stars like night, then we're stars are gemmed by the clouds. There's no more light. I'm lost in entropy.
0 grams trans fat, 0 calories, all good all of the time. Indie Nation.